The issue at stake was not so much that Henry wanted to kill her because she was Protestant. The issue was more that, you know, she was part of this elaborate court politics. And so she played it well. She didn't deny her faith, but she just told him, I'm not trying to you're smarter than me. I'm not trying to dispute with you. You know, you're my husband, you're in charge. She kind of just stroked his ego and he backed down.
The Lineage Journey podcast, unscripted conversations that aim to help you on the journey of discovering your lineage. Join us as we take a deeper look into past lineage episodes and see the lessons we can learn for today.
Suki lives in Melbourne, Australia with a husband and two daughters, combining her duties as mother and wife. She is also a formidable writer and historian and has been a part of the Lineage team since the first year that we launched. She has written hundreds of articles and scripts for Lineage and other media ministries and has a passion to share how history shapes identity and how our identity defines our mission and purpose in life. Suki is a valued member of the Lineage team and we're glad that we can interview her today. Suki, welcome. Thank you for joining us. Just where are you joining us from today?
I am in Melbourne. I'm at the Faith FM studios in Melbourne, Australia.
Okay, thanks for joining us. You are, I don't know, 13 hours ahead of me right now, but thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule as a wife, a mother of two, an author, a scriptwriter, and many, many other things that you do. Thanks for taking the time to join us. And for this Lineage Journey podcast, we're going to be discussing a subject I know that's dear to your heart and I think to many, many of our listeners as well, as we talk about the women of the Reformation. The women of the Reformation. Oftentimes the men get the spotlight and the highlight, and maybe they did play a bigger role. I don't know. We'll discuss about that as we go on. But I believe the women played a key role, maybe one that has not been focused on as much in the past. But you're recently an author. Could you share a little bit about the book that you published and a little bit behind that, and then we'll go from there?
Yes. So 2020 was really exciting for me. Even though we were in the middle of COVID, I wrote a book. The background to the book really is fairly straightforward. I've always been interested in the Reformation. I've always been interested in that period of time. I remember when I was really young, I must have been about 12, I read The Great Controversy for the first time with my mother, and I was just really fascinated with the stories of Luther and Calvin and Zwingli. And then a couple of years ago, I just connected with Lineage, because at that time we were doing season one, and I reached out and connected with you guys. And since then I've been writing content and managing the website. And in 2018, we decided to do a series of blog posts on women of the Reformation. Mm-hmm. And I started digging into the history of some of these women that I'd found really fascinating. And I was really blown away. I was blown away by the stories. And I was blown away also by the fact that I'd never heard about them. And I was thinking, if I haven't heard about them, well, I mean, how many other people have heard about them? Mm-hmm. And I started digging into it. I wrote the four blog posts. And then over time, as I continued to populate the blog, I wrote more about women from that period of time. And I thought, hey, it'd be good if I could turn this into a book. And not just a book of facts, but a book of stories. Because people like a good story. And I thought that a lot of the information that I was reading about these women just had like really good stories tacked onto them as well. And so, yeah, that's really the background for the book. It was the time that I spent wading through reams of information for my work for Lineage.
Well, it's a great book. I had the chance to read it a few weeks ago, and thank you for putting that together. I know several people have bought it already and have been blessed by it as well. So thank you for that. So, I mean, as you said, it wasn't necessarily always a passion that you had, but, you know, there was circumstances of the moment that caused you to research and write these. And then it, you know, what started out as a blog for a website has now turned into a book. And I think that's often the case in life with many projects. We start them out with one thing, and then the Lord has something bigger for them than what we originally started them out as. So
yeah. Yeah, I think, yeah, that's really true. Yep.
Do you think, I mean, I mentioned this slightly in my introduction, you know, you've got eight women that you highlight in your book. Obviously there's a lot more women than that you could have put in there. And maybe you can share a bit later on how you decided on which eight to put in. But do you think the role of women was equal to men, or it just wasn't recorded, or is still a key role? But, you know, what's your thoughts on that subject?
I think in early modern Europe, because that's, you know, that's the period of history that the book is about. The women are, you know, part of the Reformation. And so most of them are, you know, live during that period of early modern history. Women weren't equal. They weren't even perceived as being equal. I think at that point in history, and for many, many years later, women were looked on as, commodities, really, like regardless of your station in life, whether you were a peasant or whether you were a queen, you really as a woman had two roles. If you were a part of the nobility, then you were expected to marry well, because, you know, whoever you married would give your family some kind of leverage, political, financial. And so you were a commodity to be traded on the marriage market. And then you were just supposed to have kids because you know, that was really the role of even the queen. Okay, even the Queen of England was just there to produce the next heir. And if she couldn't do it, well, then she needed to be removed and somebody else needed to be given her job. And so I think that was the view of women for just many years during that period of early modern history and later. And you see that reflected in the literature of the time, in how few female narratives there are. Women were just not focused on. And so the few female narratives that we do have, or the little bits of information that we do have, are women that really rock the boat. You know, they had to make a big splash in order to get noticed. And so that's something that I noticed when I was first researching.
Mm-hmm. What would you say are some of the key points that your book tries to address?
When I was writing the book, I really wanted to look at the idea of religious liberty, because I feel like the Reformation and the period immediately after it, this was a big, big issue, you know, a social issue, because during that time, they had this idea of the divine right of kings. They had, you know, this concept of how the king was basically almost in control of the minds of his subjects. And then the king in turn was controlled by the church, by the Pope. And so I just found it really fascinating, this idea of how religious liberty, freedom of conscience, independent thought was something that was basically censored during that period of time. And so that was one thing that I really wanted to look at.
Okay.
Religious liberty. Mm-hmm. But the other thing that I really wanted to look at was the courage that these women had, you know, being women during this period of time, for them to make the choices that they made, for them to act the way they acted, took an enormous amount of courage. And I thought that was worth talking about, you know, worth highlighting, because I don't think even now, you know, we would fully comprehend their courage. And the third thing that I wanted to talk about is the idea of faith. How willing we are to choose to stand for what we believe in, even when things are hard. You know, how willing are we to make hard choices for God? And so those were really the three key points: religious liberty, faith, and then courage.
And I think those are all things that are relevant to women today. Like, if we could learn those lessons today, whether women or men, those are all key things: understanding the importance of religious liberty, courage, and how faith needs to be integral to who we are as people. So, yeah. A couple of, I mean, and maybe let's kind of delve into a few characters of the book. I mean, your first chapter in the book is Katharina von Bora, and she's a fascinating character. I love her story, and just, you know, I can't remember when it was, a few years ago, when I found out that she was a nun who escaped and then marries Martin Luther. It's like, it's a type of thing you would write about in a fiction story, but then you realize that this is the real life of one of the greatest reformers that there is. So in what ways was she a role model for a Protestant home, or a pastor's wife? I mean, because we didn't have pastor's wives before this. She was kind of the first one, really, wasn't she?
Yeah, yeah. And I think truth is stranger than fiction, right? Sometimes. And I think with the story of Katharina von Bora, her story, when I read about the whole escaping the convent in fish barrels, mm-hmm. I was thinking, I have got to tell this story. I wrote it for the blog on the Lineage website.
I mean, fish stink, imagine.
Yes. Yeah, so I was thinking they were really brave. And then even more fascinating was the fact that Martin Luther is the one that organized their escape. Yeah. And so this idea of this renegade monk springing these nine nuns from a convent in the dead of night, they were pretty revolutionary. And then, you know, added to that was the fact that she eventually married him, and their home became kind of, like you were saying, like the first home of the Reformation. You know, this idea of clergy being married was so new, so strange. If I remember correctly, they got married in 1525. And so it was still early days in the Reformation,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It was just something that was starting to just take hold. And this idea that this monk would not only like leave the church, but then he'd spring this nun and then he'd marry the nun. I mean, I remember reading, and I put this in the book, Henry VIII of England wrote and told him, you know, the only reason you wanted to become a Protestant is because you wanted to get married. And then somebody else wrote and told him, oh, you know, any offspring that you have will be the Antichrist. And it was just this, it was a big uproar, you know.
That's but a bit rich coming from Henry VIII.
I know. But this was 10 years before he broke with the church, right? So he was in a position where he felt he could judge. But I thought that was really interesting. Their home was the first, really first Protestant home. I mean, you did have Ulrich Zwingli and Anna Zwingli, who got married around this or maybe a bit after. But they're, I mean, because Luther had made such waves in Europe, you know, he had just openly stood up to the Pope. This was after the Diet of Worms. You know, it was a big deal. And so for him to get married, their home was looked on really as one of the first Protestant homes, what it would look like for a pastor's home, you know, to function and operate. And she was essentially the first real Protestant pastor's wife. Mm. And so, but I think she was equal to the task.
You know, so. How do you think she complimented Martin Luther? He was a single monk, obviously, like all were before that. How did she compliment him, or how was his ministry broadened by marrying her that maybe he wouldn't have had without?
I think it's really interesting when you look at their story. She was not afraid to stand up to him, which I thought was really interesting. Martin Luther was two things. One was he was a man who was just in a lot of emotional and mental turmoil. Two was he was really a strong-willed man. I mean, he was really strong-willed and opinionated. And so it was just this really interesting mix of personality. I think Katharina von Bora was not afraid to stand up to him. She was as tough as he was. And so, you know, one thing that I read about was because Luther had these table talk sessions where he had people in his home gather around his table and they debated stuff. And a lot of the table talk sessions were recorded. And there was one instance where, you know, he was debating this point and Katharina jumped into the fray. And she debated him into the ground until he finally was like, fine, I give up, you know.
Wow.
He basically said, you know, you have sway in my home and then you debate with me. And he was just really angry. He called her Lord Katie. That was his nickname.
Lord Katie. Uh-huh.
And that was an actual, he would use that name when he wrote to his friends. And so she was able to handle him. She didn't back down. She pushed back. But I think she was also really, she was really organized. I think he wasn't really organized. She was able to take over the running of the home and take over the care of the children and just do things that he couldn't do. And so I think her personality really complimented him in that sense. She was more organized. I think she was a lot more mentally stable. I haven't really read anything specific about that, but when you read between the lines, you see Luther really struggled, you know, with just emotionally, he struggled a lot. But Katharina didn't. So I think that, you know, she was a lot more emotionally stable, and then she was as strong a personality as he was. So it was
funny. I mean, this is subjective or conjecture question. Do you think he would have been as effective without her? Or is that, I mean, it's hard to gauge, and he had already done some things before he married her, but
yeah.
Yeah.
I think she made him more effective in the later years of his ministry. I mean, by the time they got married, he'd already done the bulk of his you know, a lot of it had happened. You know, the 95 Theses had happened. He'd already disputed with Dr. Eck at Leipzig. He'd already been to the Diet of Worms. He'd, you know, he'd already translated the English Bible, translated the Bible into German, you know, at Wartburg. So a lot of things had happened. But I think, you know, when they got married, it was more that it was, you know, the upheaval, the really big upheavals of the early, you know, the early period of his career, those big upheavals, you know, the break with the church, all of that had happened. And then after they got married, his work was a little bit more stable, you know, if that, before they got married, yeah, like all the big things, the peasant revolts, all of that had happened before they got married. After they got married, it was more this stable continuation of building on what he had already worked so hard to establish. And I think she helped with that. She helped with the stability and the continuity of, you know, the later years of his ministry. So I think that she was important.
Did they have children?
Yes, they had six, I believe. They lost a few. They lost, I think, two. I can't remember off the top of my head right now, but I know they had about six children, their oldest son, Hans. And they lost, I think, two daughters. They knew what it was like to be parents. And they also, they struggled over the grief of losing their children. So that was hard. Mm.
But I think the most fascinating thing about them is how they actually got married.
Yes. Yes. So just to tell the story, it's one of my favorite parts of her story because he sprung her from the Marienthorn convert in Nimshin in about 1523. And then there were nine of them. And Luther took financial responsibility for these nine nuns. Because the thing is, in that time, you know, during that period of time, if you're a woman, you couldn't just be like, I'm going to leave you and go set up a house by myself. Like, women needed a male protector in Europe at that time. They needed a male sponsor, not just to provide for them, but just to keep, just for them to be respectable, they needed a man behind them. So this idea of divorce, this idea of living on your own, being single was not an option. Mm-hmm. So when they left the convent, Luther agreed to sponsor them until they could find husbands. And all the eight of the nine nuns got married and Katharina couldn't. You know, she really liked this guy, Hieronymus Baumgartner, but his family was like, no, because she's a runaway nun. Like, it was just not respectable to marry a runaway nun. And then she got desperate and she wrote to Nicholas von Amstorff. In my book, I write the scene as a conversation. She actually wrote to him and she told him, look, I am at my wit's end and I need to get married. And so they try to get her married to this other older guy. And she's like, I am not going to be like, she didn't roll over and let them just marry her off. And so then she said to Nicholas, look, Nicholas, the only two options are either I marry you or Martin Luther. And Nicholas was like, I don't think you're marrying me. And so he set her up with Martin Luther. So it was really interesting. She was so progressive for her time. I don't think she thought about being progressive. I think she was just really strong-willed and really desperate. So she just told the guys, look, get your act together and one of you's got to marry me. And up until the very last minute, Luther was writing to his friends saying, I'm never going to get married. I'm never going to get married. And then he got married and everybody was like, wait, what? What just happened here? And so it's really, really, it was really interesting how she kind of, not that she forced him, but I think she pushed him into a corner. And it was, yeah, the way she handled it was really interesting.
I think it's fascinating that she proposed to him. And I think it's a great snippet of history that maybe not too many people know, but
yeah,
I don't know if we'd say she leaves a precedent for people today, but at least she the precedent is definitely a countercultural one, and one where they weren't bound by societal norms, and you know, they made it work for themselves. So yes.
And I think they were really practical. I mean, you know, as a girl in this day and age, I'm happy that my husband proposed to me, you know. But in that period of time, she was just literally desperate. You know, she had no romantic notions. She's just like, I need a man to provide for me. You sprung me. You told me that you were going to be responsible for me. Now you need to take responsibility. And I thought that was really interesting. Like, she just kind of held him accountable.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, your book's got some other fascinating characters in there. I mean, maybe just share with, how did you decide you're going to pick these ones? And there's some, obviously, you haven't, well, you can't put everyone in there, but you've got some other fascinating characters in there.
I think I did a few for the Lineage blog, and I think three of those four, I love their stories. So Katrina von Bora, Charlotte Abelest, and Louise de Coligny, I really, really like their stories. The other women, Marie Durong, I loved her story also because I watched him. I never heard of Marie Durong. And then when I watched the Lineage episode and I had to research and write about her for the Lineage episode, I really fell in love with her story and her brother Pierre's story as well. So those four were mainly from and then Catherine Brandon, that was also from the blog because later on I found her story and I wrote about her. Those were mainly from the blog from my work with Lineage. Catherine Pa. I didn't write a blog post on her, but I read a book about her. And there was this entire section of her story that's recorded in Fox's Book of Martyrs that I'd never heard about how she was nearly arrested and beheaded because of this basically political plot between, the old religion in England wanting to get rid of her because she was so staunchly Protestant. And as I read this book and then I read Fox, I realized, wow, she made a significant contribution to the Reformation in England, both with her writing and her influence. And I thought, wow, I want to tell her story. It's really, really important that I tell her story. And so that was the other one. Olympia Morata, again, I didn't write a blog about her, but I read her story in a book too, and I thought this is really cool, especially her escape from one of the towns there. And I thought, wow, I want to tell this story. So the majority of that was from the research that I did for the Lineage blog, and then that created an interest. And then I started reading other ones, and I think what led me to pick them specifically is that as I was reading their stories, researching their stories, there was some really good just stories in there. You know, you read it and you think this would read really well in fiction. So you can actually write this as a story. No, this is not just a narration of facts. You could at least actually tell this as a story and it would be really good. And so I think that's why I picked it for a story, pick the stories for their story value. And then I just built in the historical facts into that. Yeah.
Okay. And for those listening, if you're wondering where you can get the book from, there's a variety of places you can buy the book on the Lineage Journey website. That's one place where you can get it. You can also buy it at the Science Publishing for those who live in Australia.
Adventist Book Centres in Australia and New Zealand. Yep.
And I believe it's also on Kindle, if I'm correct.
Yes, it's on Kindle. And by the time this podcast is released, it will be on Amazon, Booktopia and Book Depository as well. Okay. So you can get it on all those
platforms as well.
All those platforms as well.
Lineage is a non-profit organization kept running by generous donors like you. Support us today on patreon.com/lineagejourney.
We're doing a book giveaway for one winner selected at random. Follow us on all our socials, look out for the giveaway post, like, comment, and tag a friend using the hashtag #TheLineageJourneyPodcast. Sisters in Arms is available to purchase at lineagejourney.com/shop. History shapes identity. Identity shapes mission. And a clear mission determines the trajectory of your future. Knowing where you come from is key to understanding your present purpose and your future mission. Lineage Journey is a series of videos that will take you on a journey through time, discovering the key people and events that have shaped the Christian faith. From the Waldenses to Martin Luther to Zwingli, from England to France, Switzerland to Germany, the light broke over the horizon of Europe, piercing through the Dark Ages, and then spread out over the world. As the United States of America rose to supremacy, Christianity formed the bedrock of this great nation. And so from the Great Awakening to the Great Disappointment and beyond, Lineage follows the journey of God's church throughout time, immersing you in the places, the stories, and the people through whom Christianity has shone the brightest. Join us on a journey through time. Follow us on social media at Lineage Journey or check out our website at lineagejourney.com. Lineage Journey not only produces video content, but instructive and illuminating resources to teach young and old about Christian history. Lineage has produced an educational coloring book for people of all ages. It includes original artwork from Ashley Bloom, highlighting the various heroes of the Reformation. Each scene has a matching story, and there are also QR codes to connect you to the website for more information and to watch the videos. There are also fun facts and memorable quotes to accompany the scenes to color in. Designed for young and old alike, get your copy now at lineagejourney.com.
So one of your characters you look at in the book is called Margaret of Navarre. And when that chapter ends, I want to know more about her life. It's a fascinating insight into the life of someone who continued to live as a Protestant in a Catholic home. And I think in many ways, she's a model for people today in certain situations where you've got your convictions, you've got your family, and they go in a different way, but yet she still was able to stand for her convictions at the same time as not maybe break that bond with her family as well.
Yeah. That's one of the reasons why I wanted to write her story. Margaret of Navarre was just in an incredibly privileged position. Mostly because, it was really interesting because there was just the three of them. Her father was a distant cousin of the King of France. And French law forbade women from ever taking the throne. They had a law called the Salic Law, and only men could take the throne. Mm. And so what happened was if a king got married and his wife didn't produce a male heir, then the throne would go to the nearest cousin in line, you know? They were called princes of the blood. And Margaret's father was a prince of the blood, and that when King Louis XII died, the throne went to her brother, Francis. And Margaret and her mother were just devoted to Francis. And, lots of historians, secular historians, Christian historians, they all talk about the kind of bond that Margaret had with her brother Francis. They were really, really close. It's like Margaret just poured her entire life into Francis. They had this really close bond. In fact, when he took the throne, it was their mother and then Margaret that really ran the court, not even Francis's wife. She wasn't really in there. You know, Margaret was the one that hosted the parties. She was the one that was the forward face of the diplomatic liaising in a lot of the cases. She was just the life of the court, more so than even the queen consort. And so they had this really incredible bond. And then as I was reading, there were these instances where I read about where she really pushed the envelope with Protestantism. She didn't go fully Protestant. You know, there were a little bit of mystical ideas with her. But what did happen is she believed in justification by faith, this idea of forgiveness and grace and faith. And that was really pushing the envelope. Her brother was indulgent. And a lot of the times he kind of just turned a blind eye. It was not really a big deal for him at that time, Protestantism in France. It didn't meddle with his sovereignty.
His power, yeah.
Yeah. But then when it started to kind of impact his sovereignty, his power on the throne, especially French kings, it was a really big thing, the divine right of kings and the absolutism, where the king had absolute power over the nobility, more so than even in England, because in England the nobility had a little bit more power, a little bit more leeway, but in France the king really wanted to have that kind of absolute sway. And then she found that she and her brother were starting to clash, and they really clashed over, I know, after the affair of the placards. And I'd never heard about the affair of the placards. It's funny. I mean, I read The Great Controversy and I was aware of it, but I hadn't really understood it till I watched till we did the episode with Lineage, and I had to research it. And then to see how that episode strained Margaret's relationship with her brother. And I mean, I read about it in some Christian history sources, and then I read about it in this purely academic source as well, done by these two professors out of Columbia University, where they talk about how that incident, you know, when you read letters that Margaret wrote to Francis, it strained their relationship potentially for the rest of their lives. And I thought that would have taken a lot of courage.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to write about that. That's actually why I wanted to write that story, because I think it's so relevant. You know, when we have beliefs, especially in the time that we live in, when you're a Christian and you have beliefs that are so radically divergent from the norm, especially if you're within the same family. I wanted to look at the dynamic of how faith affects family relationships and how, it's important, and how it was really hard. And yet she, you know, how they did their best to kind of keep their relationship going. I mean, they didn't fall out completely, their relationship. They continued, you know, they had a relationship for the rest of their lives, but it was strained. It was never the same again. And I thought that was something that I really wanted to look at and explore, and the kind of courage that it would have taken Margaret to do that as a woman. Because really, she was dependent on Francis as king of France. She was queen of Navarre, definitely, but Navarre was a small state. And if you look at the politics of the time, Navarre at that time was, you know, France was divided in the sense that Spain had already taken a part of Navarre. And so the sovereignty of Navarre depended on how willing France was to protect them. And so, you know, it was political. Like, if Francis cut off his support of Navarre, that would have been disastrous. But there was so many considerations, and Francis cut off his support of her personally, she would have been destitute, you know. She was dependent on him. Yeah.
So she wrote a book. Maybe just share a few comments on that. The Mirror of the Sinful Soul.
Yes. So she wrote a book called The Mirror of the Sinful Soul, which basically covered the idea of justification by faith. Then, you know, the Department of Theology at the University of Paris, or the Sorbonne, as we know it today, picked up the book, and they made a huge hue and cry over it. There was a monk there called Noel Bida. He wanted her to be tried for heresy, you know, and he just whipped up the Parlement of France at that time was like the judicial body that tried heretics, and he whipped them up into a frenzy. They wanted to like prosecute her for being a heretic, and Francis had to come in and like save his sister and put down the revolt. But then interestingly, that book was one of the first books written by a woman, you know, at that time. It was really cool. And then that book made its way to England, and the young Princess Elizabeth, she translated that book for her stepmother, Queen Catherine Parr. It was for the Christmas. It was a Christmas gift.
There's a connection.
Yeah.
We'll talk about Catherine Parr in a minute. Yeah, that's fascinating. Yeah.
And so I think it was really fascinating how they influenced each other, how women influenced each other during this time. They were like a network. Yeah.
Yeah, we'll come back to that. But the next character I wanted to ask you about is Marie Durand. I mean, she was one of the first... I mean, we include her in our season of Lineage. We did an episode on her. It's a fascinating place to visit her house and the tower where she was kept in prison.
Yeah.
I think what stood out to me when I read that chapter in your book was how you play with the idea that she possibly could have avoided prison, where they came to question her, said, you know, who, and obviously in those days there was no Instagram, Facebook or facial recognition. So they didn't know who was who, and, you know, maybe share a little bit about that, because that really stood out to me, that point, and how she took a stand.
Yes, I think that was something that I wanted to play with, because when I was reading, there's really not a lot of information on her. You know, there's even less information on her in English. And I can't read French. I remember struggling. I read a little bit of it. I can, you know, manage with the dictionary. But I remember reading this one article on her that was really good, that was in French, that I was struggling through. But it's difficult to find information on her. And so when I looked at some of the information that was available, one of the things that was suggested in one of the books that I read was this idea that she was, and there's a dispute here. Some sources say she was just engaged to Matthew Serres. The others say she was married. And there's this one piece of information that I read that talks about how she was actually married to him but she chose to keep her own name.
Yeah, that's Marie Durand was her family name.
That's right. Durand was her family name. Now, if she had changed it to Serez, they wouldn't potentially, you know, she could have kind of, you know, she could have gone undercover and not gotten into trouble, because the reason she was arrested was because of Pierre Durand, because of her brother. Because he was a pastor, and they arrested his entire family and extended family. You know, when you read, I read some of the letters that have been translated into English of, you know, that Matthew had exchanged with her. And it sounds like they're married when you read those letters, the way he talks about, I can't wait for us to be together again, you know. And so I went with the premise that they were married. And I wanted to explore this idea of how she could have taken her husband's name and dodged the bullet. But she didn't. She kind of kept her own name. And it's really interesting. We know she kept her own name because it was entered as Marie Durand into the rolls
in the prison.
Power.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that was really, I thought that was fascinating. And interestingly, recently I found out she, you know, it wasn't Marie Durand. Marie Durand was the only one who did that. Anne Askew, another Protestant in England, she did that as well. You know, this idea of holding onto their own names when they could have hidden their identities in with their husbands. And yet they didn't choose to do that. They chose to hold on to their own names and potentially pay a price because of it. I thought it's really interesting. And I wanted to look at that because I thought it was really brave of her to do it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, 38 years in prison when she could have potentially said, I'm somebody else and avoid that. But she owned up to her brother being a pastor and pays for it, you know, for decades of her life. It brings to mind a quote from, it's not a phantom quote, but I can't remember what it's from. But there was one of the reformers who could have dodged a martyr's death as well, but he said there comes a time when the bravest of men just have to kind of take a stand and stand where they are and take it. But I wanted to explore that what you mentioned earlier about the mirror of the sinful soul that Margaret of Navarre wrote, and the Catherines that you put in your book at the last two chapters is Catherine Parr and Catherine Brandon. I found those fascinating. Firstly, the second Catherine lives about 30 minutes from my house, which I thought, wow, you know, when this Corona COVID thing's over, I'll go pay it a visit. And secondly, we learn the history of the mid 1500s, which is a very interesting part of British history with Henry VIII and Edward, and then, you know, Lady Jane Grey, and then Mary and so on. But as I was reading that, I just thought of the strategic role that a woman played in that whole thing, that ties history. So
when I was originally, the Catherine Parr was not in the book. I had written a short story on Anna Zwingli. And then when my editor read it, she was like, no, you can't put that. Either you fix that story or drop it and pick somebody else. And so I was like, I looked at Anna Zwingli again and I thought, oh, I can't fix it. Like, I can't make it as fun as the other ones. And then I'd already read a book on Catherine Parr. And so I went to dig, and I bought a historical book that was done by an academic on her, and I read it. And I was, what stood out to me, so many things that stood out to me about Catherine Parr. The first thing that stood out to me was that she was an author. At a time when there were very, very few to none female authors in England. And then she was published, she self-published. And so that I found fascinating. But she was also a translator. She translated the Bible, which was really interesting because, you know, a lot of the up to that point, it was just Wycliffe and Tyndale that had really had a go at publishing, translating the Bible into English. But she translated portions of the Bible, the Gospels. And she, because of that, she had this huge influence on the ladies in her apartments, in her rooms. Mm-hmm. But the other thing that really stood out to me about her was that she was married. She was twice married before she married Henry VIII, and she never had children. She just had stepchildren from her second marriage. Mm-hmm. And so when she came into this marriage with Henry, she had these three stepchildren. She was about 30 when she married Henry. And at that time, Mary Tudor, who later became Mary the First of England, she was 27. And the other two, Elizabeth and Edward, were really young. I think Elizabeth was 9, Edward was like 5. And she really wrapped herself around Elizabeth and Edward. because both of them didn't have mothers. Elizabeth's mother was beheaded when she was 2, and then Edward's mother died giving birth to him. And so Catherine just kind of adopted them as her own. And then as she continued to study the Bible, she was influenced by Cranmer, by Latimer, by Ridley. As she, you know, she was influenced by them, she began to make sure that the children, Elizabeth and Edward, were raised Protestant. She got some of the best Protestant tutors for them from Cambridge. Cambridge at that time was a hotspot of Protestantism. All the great Protestant thinkers were at Cambridge. And so she got these tutors. She raised these children in Protestantism. And, you know, Edward was going to be monarch after his father died. And so I really like to play with this idea because I thought, and you know, my editor and I discussed it as well, but we thought it was really interesting that she, as a mother, she invested in this 5-year-old boy, invested in him spiritually, invested in him academically, so that when Edward took the throne, England became really strongly Protestant.
He was very strong.
Yes, and the reforms that he brought about are what turned the tide in England towards a more like towards the Reformation, towards Protestantism. Henry VIII was just dabbling. You know, he was neither here nor there. He broke with the church, broke with the Catholic Church, so that allowed Protestantism to kind of seep into England. But it wasn't really a strong stand that he took. But Edward was a strong Protestant, and that was because of the investment that Catherine made from a very young age. She was 5 when she got married to Henry. And so I thought that was really, really interesting, really important, the investment that she made.
Yeah, I find that fascinating. You know, she, like you said, she didn't have her own kids, and she probably didn't want to marry Henry VIII either.
No.
And so she finds herself married to this crazy king who's killed all these other women and got rid of them. And but yet she makes it invest in the situation where she can and change the trajectory of the nation, really.
Yes. You know, it would have been scary because the previous queen, the queen that came before her, was Catherine too, Catherine Howard, and she was beheaded. Mm-hmm. And so then step into those shoes. Henry was such a volatile man. He'd like beheaded 2 of his queens, exiled another. Like he was just a little nuts. And so to come into that situation and then to love the kids and to invest in them. I believe she really did change the religious trajectory of the nation. Because even though Edward died young, and then you had Mary's brief reign when she was, and she reverted the England back to Catholicism. Then came Elizabeth, who reigned for a long, long, long time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, again, Elizabeth was deeply inspired by Catherine, not just in terms of her spirituality, but what it looked like to be a spiritual-minded monarch. Because there was a period of time when Henry was in France that he left Catherine to be regent of England. And she managed England while he was away. Mm. While she was regent, the kids came to stay with her. And so Elizabeth would have seen her, she would have seen her praying, translating the Bible, and then also ruling the kingdom. Mm-hmm. So she would have understood the dynamics of being a Protestant monarch. When she watched Catherine, that would have been a key influence. Catherine was a key influence in her life.
What do you think about the episode in her life? And I've read it in other places as well, where it appears like she was going to suffer the fate of her predecessor and, be dethroned or killed or something like that. But yet she manages to placate her husband's anger or pride or something and stays on. And I found kind of maybe comparing that with Marie Durand or some of the other stands, kind of interesting that each woman made maybe a different stand, but still.
I thought it was interesting to write those stories because I think that just the variety of it, the idea that you don't always have to be a martyr. I mean, Marie was almost a martyr. Like she suffered for her faith. She made hard choices because she didn't have any other choice, because to do so would be to lie about her faith, to hide it under the name Serez, to pretend not to know her brother, would be to deny her faith. You know, she was a Protestant and she didn't want to deny that. And the only way that she could stand for that was by saying, I am Marie Durand. In Catherine's case, the issue wasn't her Protestantism. The issue was religious politics in the English court. The issue was that the court of England was divided. That she understood, I think she understood what was at stake. I mean, I like to think so when I read it. I mean, with history, you never know exactly what happened because you weren't there. You're reading things that, you know, somebody else's account of it. But when I look at it, especially when I look at Fox's account of it in Fox's Book of Martyrs, he would be the closest because he wrote those. That particular one was written in 1584, which was very, very close to the event. So, you know, you're going to want to take that as a primary source. But it's just this idea of how people like Stephen Gardiner wanted the Court of England to become Catholic again. They wanted some form of power, and they could see that the advisors around Henry, some of Henry's strongest advisors at that point were Edward the Sixth uncles, the Seymours, Edward Seymour and Tom Seymour. They were Protestant. You know, and so there was just this factionalism there. And Catherine got caught in the crossfire. They knew she was Protestant. They knew, Thomas Cranmer was also, Henry VIII died holding Cranmer's hand. And so these were people that were deeply Protestant and they were close to the king. And then people like Stephen Gardiner, Thomas Wriothesley and Richard Rich, they were on the other faction. They were the Catholics and they kind of wanted some of the power because they were afraid what's going to happen to us when Henry dies? Are we going to lose our heads, lose our positions, you know? So it was just this factionalism. They wanted to get rid of the queen because they could see the kind of influence that she had on the prince, Edward the Sixth. They could see the Protestant influence there. They wanted to get rid of her and they played on Henry's ego. Henry didn't like outspoken wives. That's the bottom line. Catherine of Aragon was extremely outspoken. He got rid of her ruthlessly. You know, she died in Kimbolton Castle of just cold and old age and neglect. And then Anne Boleyn was also loud and outspoken, couldn't give him a son. He beheaded her. He liked Anne of Cleves because when he told her to step aside, she quietly did what she was told. Catherine Parr started to debate with him on spiritual topics. Henry was a man with a massive ego. He did not like it when people told him that he was wrong. That was one of his biggest problems. You know, he killed his courtiers, some of his best advisors, because he just didn't like it that they were better than him. And so when she came and she started debating with him, you know, they could play on his ego. This fact that, you know, your wife is smarter, they're trying to act smarter than you. So she understood the issue at stake was not so much that Henry wanted to kill her because she was Protestant. The issue was more that, you know, she was part of this elaborate court politics. So she played it well. She didn't deny her faith, but she just told him, you're smarter than me. I'm not trying to dispute with you. You know, you're my husband. You're in charge. She kind of just stroked his ego and he backed down.
But he still had a bit of drama left in him because he didn't tell.
Yes. And that, again, is classic Henry VIII. Because if you look at the politics of his time, the way he handled his courtiers was like that. He understood the factions and he liked to play them against each other so that none of them would have power. So that he would always be the linchpin. He did that on numerous occasions. You know, whenever he felt like somebody was gathering too much power, like Thomas Cromwell, he beheaded them for trumped up reasons. You know, he played them against each other. And so this was classic. He could see that people like Gardiner and Wriothesley were kind of, you know, getting a bit too big for their boots and he let them go. And then when Catherine kind of humbled herself, he was like, oh, well, you know, they weren't useful to him anymore. He didn't want to humble his wife anymore. She'd already humbled herself. So she was like, oh, he was like, well, let's play this, you know, let me play this against them. He was a really, he was a really interesting monarch. But yeah, I think in the 16th century, one of the big things that a lot of the reformers, men or women, had to deal with was the line between something that was politically motivated versus something that was principled. And there were a lot of things in their world where where religion and politics mixed because of the way the church was, the way the church operated, the Catholic Church operated in both the spiritual and the temporal realm. For example, the King of France got his sovereignty to rule came from the church. You know, so if France defected from the church, where would the sovereignty of the king come from? So it was so closely tied. So inevitably the Reformation became politicized. But it was also a movement of ideas, a movement of principles, a movement that was based on the Bible. And so you see this tension between the politics of the time versus the principles of the time. And that was a really fine line actually for people to tread. And I thought, that's the difference between Marie Durand and Catherine Parr. Marie Durand was principles. Catherine Parr was just really navigating the politics. And she did it really well, I thought.
That's good. Good. Yeah. Appreciate you dividing the issues there. Who would you say, maybe as we come towards, who would you say is your favorite character? Do you have a favorite one, or do you just like them all in different ways?
I think my favorite's Louise de Coligny, only because she was in Paris when the Saint Bartholomew's Day Massacre happened. Again, I'd not heard about the Saint Bartholomew's Day Massacre till I worked on the Lineage episode, and then I was just shocked by what I read. But I thought it was really fascinating because she was in Paris the night the massacre happened. Her father was one of the prime targets; he was assassinated. Her husband was killed. She escaped to Switzerland. And then the crown wrote to her and told her that if she recanted her fate, they would give her her assets back. And she told them, forget it. And then she married William of Orange, who was also massively Protestant champion. And then he was shot like her husband or dad. And yet, even after that, she continued to be faithful. She had a huge influence in the Dutch Reformation after that, after her husband was shot. She continued to be faithful. And I thought, how many people can go through the trauma that she went through? You know, I was reading a letter, a snippet of a letter where she writes, I saw my husband and my father killed before my eyes. And I incorporate that into my story because I was like, how would she have seen him die? And I kind of imagined how it would have happened. But she says that, you know, so imagine going through the trauma of seeing your father die. She saw, I don't know what I don't think she saw her first husband die, but I know she saw her second husband die. As you know, you go through this trauma after trauma, and yet to still be faithful to God, to still not walk away from God, to still not shake her face at God. I was just so inspired by her story, by her faith.
Yeah, it's a fascinating chapter. Fascinating chapter. Well, thank you. Thank you for taking the time to share with us. And these snippets of the women we've mentioned, Margaret, Marie, and Catherine, and Louise, and but there's more in the book. So for those of you who are listening, if you haven't got your hands on a copy of the book yet, please do get yourself one ordered and read these inspiring stories of these women of generations ago. But just remind us of the those three key points you wanted to share again as we close.
Yep. So religious liberty, courage, and faith. Those were the three things that I wanted to really explore in the book.
And those are three things that we all need to remember today, that the importance of religious liberty, especially in these times in which we're living, where we're seeing, you know, rights being reduced in different countries around the world, and the importance of having courage in the hard times we live in, the importance of being men and women of faith. So thank you for writing the book. Thank you for being part of the Lineage Journey team. And thank you for providing this resource to those who wish to get it on how they can educate themselves more on the role of women in the Reformation. So thank you for taking the time to be with us on this Lineage Journey podcast.
And thank you for having me.
And for those of you listening, thank you for listening to the Lineage Journey podcast. And we hope to see you for our next episode in a couple of weeks.
Thank you for listening. We hope that you enjoyed this episode. Lineage Journey is supported by your generous donations. Did you know that you can donate on a monthly basis? Any amount from $2 to $100 or whatever you decide through patreon.com/lineagejourney. Your donations go towards the cost of producing our varied content, and we thank you for your support.